I'm Justin J. As a photographer, I've gotten to shoot rock stars, hip-hop moguls, world-class athletes, and some other truly extraordinary subjects. I'm fascinated by the backstories and life experiences that help shape these compelling people. The right photograph can reveal quite a lot about someone, but some stories can't be told with just a picture. Sometimes you need to sit down, listen, and dig a little deeper. This is The Plug. Nothing lasts forever, especially a winning streak. Choosing when to walk away is one of the most difficult decisions you can make in life, whether it's from a blackjack table or a successful athletic career. This next guest is an accomplished professional surfer with 3 world titles. In 2018, he made one of the most consequential decisions of his life when he chose to retire from the professional world tour. Second acts and self-reinvention can be terrifying, especially if you define yourself by what you do. He made surfing his career, but he eventually realized that he's much more than just the sum of his trophies. Today, surfer, father, and the 3-time world champion with one of the most unmistakable laughs in the game, Mr. Mick Fanning.
All right, we're rolling. Mick Fanning, good to see you, man.
You too, brother. You been well?
Yeah, it's been a difficult year, but that's nothing new. You know? I haven't seen you since Xander's been born, man. Congratulations. Welcome
Thank
to the club.
Much. Yeah, it's pretty amazing, isn't it? It's,
what are some of the biggest challenges you've had so far that you didn't expect?
Yeah, look, I guess we've been pretty lucky. He's been such a little gem of a kid. But yeah, look, that first sort of week, 2 weeks, where that jet lag, like that sleep deprivation, there's nothing like that in the world. Like, I've been on planes and stuff like that, and like, it's out of this world how tired you get. But other than that, it's been awesome, you know. It's been fun.
I think those first couple of weeks are such an amazing, magical time, and the lack of sleep, and it's just such a whirlwind, beautiful moment. And, you know, talk to me about the irony of having such an amazing personal chapter while the world is upside down. I mean, what was that like having a baby during COVID?
It was, yeah, look, I guess the one thing is that people all sit there and they go, look, 2020 was the worst year of my life, and I understand it. Like, you know, people, there was some really shit things that happened last year, but for me personally, was probably the best year of my life. You know, I got to stay home. I got to watch Xander grow in Bree's belly the whole pregnancy. Didn't miss one scan. Didn't miss like any of the important milestones. And then to be there with not, oh, I've got to get going, or, you know, I got to take off after he's born or anything like that. It was just to be in that moment was just incredible. And yeah, you sort of didn't have any FOMO of going somewhere, or, you know, everything was just home, and it was a yeah. beautiful time just to be, you know, get to know him and get to know everything without any expectations of the outside world.
It was such a strange year because it affected everybody so differently. You know, like, some people were relatively business as usual, and then some people were, you know, struck with horrific tragedy. And, you know, it's like, you know, for me personally, I just was like, got to spend a lot of time with my son, and, you know, maybe too much sometimes, you know. Like, I think at one point I was venting to my mom a couple of weeks ago, and I think she must have mentioned something to my dad, and, you know, he called me, which is, you know, pretty rare, and in his own kind of emotionally stunted way, tried to give me a little pep talk. And I was like, Dad, I'm going to just stop you right there. Like, I'm 100% aware of what an amazing time this is, and how special it is to get to spend this much concentrated time. But, you know, there's such thing as too much of a good thing, you know, like even a blessing, you know.
Yeah, no, it's funny. It's I guess we sort of, as humans, we always think the grass is always greener.
Well, I mean, I think 2020 will go down as the year of a COVID-19 sourdough bread and podcasting. You know, there's a lot of new podcasts on the scene.
I know, 100%.
How's that been going for you?
Because I was home, I sort of had time. For me, when the world sort of shut down, I guess some people were like, oh, it's time just to do nothing, where I sort of looked at it as to get on the front foot and try and do some things that I might never have done before, just to have a look at, see if I enjoyed them, see if I didn't. And, the podcast thing sort of, I didn't really want to sign up to a full-time podcast, but then it just sort of happened. And, I enjoy talking to people. I enjoy learning about people. It was really fun doing that with Sam McIntosh, and the people that we got to speak to was awesome.
Yeah, I mean, you're obviously a really personable guy, and you've had a lot of experience, you know, in front of the camera doing interviews and whatnot. But is there a little different skill set that you've developed that you didn't know that you had, or what are some of the challenges of doing a podcast and, you know, flexing skills that you thought you maybe didn't have to, that you didn't have, or?
I don't think I've got that many skills in it. I guess the biggest thing is just being a good listener and being able to shape questions around what the person's actually talking. And you sit there and some people come in with a whole list of questions and they've got to get these questions bang, 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 bang. And I sort of like to just let it flow and wherever it goes, just keep talking down these sort of pathways or railroads, whatever you want to call them, and just see where they end up. And sometimes people don't know they want to go down this path, and they get to the end of it, it's like, oh, did that just happen? Sort of cool.
I mean, it's a unique platform, because I grew up on talk shows. I love, whether it's, you know, David Letterman or, you know, Tom Snyder or Bob Costas or Phil Donahue. Like, I love all the great talk show hosts. But, you know, you realize that format is just, it's so stringent. There was a pre-produced interview, and then they do their plug, and there's like the quip or the story, and then it's like a 6-minute segment, and they cut to commercial. And, you know, that's been a challenge for me, of just like, while people are talking, I'm like, wow, this person's been rambling for 11 minutes straight. Like, is that great? Is that interesting? Do I cut them off? You know, and it's a constant learning curve of what the platform will support and what the listeners want. You know, it's really interesting.
Yeah. I guess, you know, you just take criticism as it comes. And, you know, I guess with podcasts, yeah, as long as people are talking interesting things, then people will listen. And I think a lot of things with podcasts too is that you can put them on and keep going about your work every day, where it used to be you just used to listen to the radio and do your driving, where now people put on podcasts and it just eliminates so much time when you're especially driving long distances. Like, podcasts is what I listen to.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Well, it seems like, I mean, in addition to podcasting, it seems like you've been able to make a pretty smooth transition into your post-professional surfing career. And not every athlete's been able to do that. You know, especially here in the States, you see a lot of athletes that they open a steak restaurant, or they, you know, invest in a car dealership or something. And, you know, it seems like you've made some really smart choices. I know you have a real estate portfolio, and you were one of the early investors in the Balter Brewing Company, which sold recently. And, you know, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I think it's safe to say you probably did okay on that.
We did all right.
How were you able to, you know, avoid some of the missteps that a lot of professional athletes make after their career ends? You know, do you have a business background? Do you have a strong team in your corner? I mean, how are you able to do that?
I guess when I started the tour, right, always knew there was going to be an end date. And so, like, you know, you see so many different athletes, they're just like living in the moment. They're like, all right, I'm going to have this, I'm going to compete until I'm, you know, however old, and I've got all this money now, so I'm just going to go and spend. And I didn't think about it that way, you know. I sort of, if I got a lump sum of money, then I'd try and invest into real estate, especially in my early years. Real estate was the only thing I could understand, because I could see it and I could feel it. And even if the house burnt down, I've still got the land, you know, so yeah. I didn't lose all my money, where like stocks and
racehorses.
Yeah, I can't do it, you know. There's just too many variables that I don't understand. So that's why I sort of just stuck with with real estate and buying real estate. And then I guess from the transition point of view, I actually got lucky. I guess having a sponsor like Rip Curl and Red Bull, where I was able to have 6 months off before I decided I was going to fully retire. It sort of gave me a taste of what the other side was like, gave me a look into learning what, like, when you come off tour, you're like, oh, I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to, no. You know, you've got all these places you want to go, all these waves you want to surf, all these projects that you want to do that you can't do while you're on tour. And then you start to realize it's like, well, that one's not going to work because of this, or this one's not going to work because of that. Why don't we concentrate on this one and do this one as best we possibly could? So it was sort of, you know, obviously I didn't figure it all out by myself. I have some really good people in my corner that sort of give me advice and make sure that I don't go down a silly path just because I'm hot-headed and really want to do it at that moment.
Emotional investing.
Exactly, yeah. So a lot of the times, the projects that I was trying to commit to, it was something, if I thought about it for like a week or 2 weeks and I was still as passionate after 2 weeks, then I'd go for it.
Your heart's in it. Trust your gut.
Yeah. But then other times I'd get all fired up and then I'd wake up the next day and be like, that's the dumbest idea. You know? So it took a lot to learn to go through all that. But it's been fun. I really enjoyed it. And then, I got to go back on tour for a year and really start planning out different little things, because I knew in my own mind I was going to retire in 2018. I didn't really let too many people know, but
let me stop it right there. I'm curious how you came up with that number. In retrospect, are you happy with that decision? Do you feel like you stuck around too long? Would you have liked to have had one more year? Like, are you happy? How did you come up with that? Because that must be one of the most difficult decisions for a professional athlete to make, you know, when to pull the plug and start the next chapter of their life.
Yeah, it's, to be truly honest, it's scary as hell. It's scary as hell. But for me, the scariest part for me was in the start of 2016, where I was like, I don't have enough energy. You know, I came off a really shit year in 2015, where I lost my brother and, you know, obviously the shark attack and all that sort of stuff. And so I was emotionally drained. And so at the start of 2016, I was like, I don't have the energy to do a full year on tour. And if I do go and do it, I can guarantee it's going to be my worst year on tour. And so in 2016, I rang my boss at Rip Curl and I was like, look, this is what I'm thinking. And he was like, look, if that's what you want to do, we'll support you 100%. And then it was like, all right, now I've got to ring the WSL and see if they're into it, because, you know, sometimes it's just like, once you're out, you know, there's no coming back. And so had to ring the WSL and be like, hey, this is my thoughts. And they backed me 100% as well. So it's sort of that was the scariest part. Once I did that half year, I got back on tour in 2017 full time. And I think it was the second event, I was sitting in a car park in Western Australia waiting for my heat. I was first heat of the morning and it was the most incredible day. There was, you know, waves were pumping, and I had to sit in this car park for 4 hours and wait for my heat. And I was just looking around at the world. I'm like, fuck this. I'm done. And so that was it. That was my thinking right there. So I surfed out the full year and it was at that point.
So you knew, you pretty much knew in your heart. I mean, everyone was supportive after the fact, which is terrific, but you knew when to pull the plug and you're comfortable with that decision.
Yeah. No one came and tapped me on the shoulder and said, all right, you're done or anything like that. It was on my terms. And I just lost that fire. I didn't have that fire to go in and put 100% in each and every day to go and try and win a world title. And to me, not giving it 100% I knew I was cheating myself, and that wasn't fun either. So I was just like, all right, just rip the Band-Aid off and get out of here, you old bugger.
And also, it seems like the option of having a family really isn't conducive to that lifestyle either. I know there's some people that have been able to kind of pull it off, but it must be really difficult. Moving forward, now that you're a dad, like, I know that you're not on the tour anymore and you don't have that grind, but, you know, surfing involves a lot of travel. How's Bree feel about that? How are you going to reconcile that?
Yeah, look, it's definitely a learning curve. Like, I always tell the boys, I'm like, I don't know how you guys competed on tour, because I just, especially in those first couple of months, first few months, I didn't want to leave home. I didn't even want to go for a surf. I was surfing out in front of my house, which the waves are pretty average, you know, 99% of the time. But I would just go out for 10 minutes out the front just because I didn't want to miss anything.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how the guys on tour would go and compete and this and that. And so, like, I have a lot of respect for that. But, yeah, look, I guess on the travel side with Bree, like, you know, she understands my job. And it sort of comes back to if it's something that I truly believe in and something that I think is really beneficial for the family, then she'll support 100%.
Yeah.
If it's just me, oh, I'm going to go for a boys' weekend, she's like, maybe not.
But, and it's the distinction between those two that makes all the difference, right?
Exactly. You got to word it right, people. No, I'm joking.
Well, that's amazing. Well, listen, so since the last time I saw you, you know, I missed you for a couple of years on the North Shore, but since then I finally put out the book that I've been working on for 10 years, and it's called HI1K, 10 years as 1,000 pictures from the North Shore, Hawaii. And it was just, I'm so glad that I got to get the timing down. We premiered it like the December right before COVID, and it was amazing to be able to be over there and kind of give this. I saw it as like a tribute to all of the amazing people that kind of brought me into their sphere and were candid and let me document their lives. And, you know, you were a big part of that. There's some amazing photos of you in the book. And we sat down for an interview a couple years ago, and there's one quote that really stuck out. It's like a really beautiful moment, and I just want to read it to you and get your thoughts on it. And so we sat down and you said, in 2015, it was a really heavy moment, but it was also incredible. I came in from a heat with Kelly, and all my best friends had flown over. It was the day after my brother had passed away, and everything was really, really raw. And that moment, in my eyes, to come in and see everyone, it felt like I'd won in life. Like, what a moment. You know?
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. It's bringing up emotion right now. That was a moment. Like, didn't matter if I won or lost, or like, I didn't know anyone was coming over. And, you know, I found out my brother had passed away the morning before. And so everything was extremely raw. Everything was so heightened, you know. I was like, I was trying to look after my mum who was there. And then I had incredible friends looking after me, like Taylor Knox and Jared House and you know, Fletch and Neil from Rip Curl, like, and then all my other mates that are on tour, like Parko, Kai Otten, Bede, and old Bede actually got injured too just before that. You know, he broke his pelvis. Yeah, it was just a cluster of a year, and there was like, yeah, Bede broke his pelvis, and Owen had his head injury. There was like all kinds of things going on around, and then that was sort of like the last big apple that just sort of exploded. And so yeah, like to you know, I was sort of just hanging on by the smallest of threads, and then to come in and see all my friends there was just like, I didn't ask them to come. I didn't know they were coming. They were just there. And that's you know, when people do that, that's, you've done something right in life. And, yeah, as I said, at that moment, I thought I'd won in life. I didn't care about no contest.
A really beautiful moment. I mean, so, you know, Mick, you've had a lot of tragedy and a lot of loss in your life. And, you know, the one thing that I've witnessed firsthand being friends with you and getting to be around you is you seem to have this amazing ability to kind of compartmentalize that pain. And, you know, I was in Hawaii. I was on the beach that day in 2015. And, you know, you had to paddle out and compete at pipe in a very important heat, and you just lost your brother. And like, how does someone find the strength to temporarily set aside something just so horrific and be able to focus 100% on competition for that one moment? Cause I mean, that's not something that everybody, not many people are able to do that. Like, where does that come from?
Look, I guess it was something that I learned, you know, when I lost my first brother in 98, I hate this saying, and everyone's like, oh, be strong, you know? And I sort of took it as, all right, you can't show any emotion. Like, I was 17 at the time, and, you know, I felt like I had to look after my whole family, look after my friends, and people would be crying all around me, and I was just blank-faced. I put up this wall that I didn't even realize I'd put there, and so... Even though it was such a shit moment, I learned how to differentiate my feelings to other people's. Because sometimes if I fell into those feelings with those other people, then I'd be a complete mess. And so I learned that as we went along. But then as time went on, I learned to pull down that wall and be able to trust people and tell people my feelings and stuff like that and show emotion. And then I learned to be able to separate life and work. I tried really hard for them not to mix with each other. You know, I was like, if I'm going to work, doesn't matter what happened in life up until that point, I say I'm clocking in for the work day, I was fine. And, you know, some days it didn't work, but most of the time it did. And I guess on that specific day in 2015, it was different. You know, I didn't feel that much, to be honest. I was pretty numb, but, yeah. But in saying that, I knew my brother was with me at that point. And so I knew that he would protect me out in the water. And then once I got to the beach, he looked after my mum and my family and stuff. And so I was actually really calm in that moment. All I had to do was just go surfing, and I was surfing for him at that moment as well. So yeah, it was sort of, I knew he was with me, knew I could go surfing, and I just wanted to put on the best performance I could possibly do for him.
That must have exacerbated the emotion of having all your friends there as well. I mean, because there's a difference between repressing emotion and being able to compartmentalize it and address it later on, you know, and it sounds like it meant a lot to you to have all your friends there.
Yeah, for sure. And it was another thing too, like one of my tricks that I always used was, you know, sometimes you look in the mirror or something and you're like, oh God, I know something's right there, but I don't want to deal with it right then and there. I want to deal with it later. So I sort of had this emotional or this mental room, right? And I have a treasure chest. And in the treasure chest, anything that I didn't feel like dealing with at that moment, I'd just put in the treasure chest, and I'd go back to it when I had more confidence in myself, or I had courage to deal with it, or I had time to deal with it. And so somehow I could just put the latch on it and I wouldn't think about it until I had that time to go and deal with it. So that was one of the things that I learned through, you know, talking about separating life and work. I could just put those life things in this treasure chest, and then, yeah, once I finish work, I'll go back to it.
Yeah, I mean, but that's not something that everybody can do. I mean, that's a very difficult process, you know, especially when you're dealing with something as emotional and passionate as you are about what you do, you know, surfing. It's not just a day job. You know what I mean? You're not like going to an insurance company and you're like, oh, I'll deal with this later on. I mean, it's like, yeah, I feel like your passion and your life of surfing is so wrapped up in who you are. I'm sure that must be.
Really, yeah, it's really different. But you know, at the end of the day, that was my job. So I looked at it as my job. There were growing up when I was young, I thought my whole being just revolved around being a surfer on tour.
Yeah.
Then I realized it was only something that I did. It wasn't who I was. So that's the way that I could differentiate it all.
Yeah, I mean, this has been pretty introspective year for me too. You know, like I think having so much time on your hands, not necessarily free time, but just time away from other people kind of forces you to take stock in things. And, you know, I had this realization personally that I realized, you know, maybe I'm not destined for greatness. You know, maybe I'm destined for pretty goodness, you know, but without a lot of, relative effort, you know, and there's something to be said for that. That's afforded me a really nice lifestyle and time with my family and time with my friends and leisure time, you know, and being a B+ at life is not all that bad, but
who's judging that?
You know, I mean, I'm putting it in perspective, but you know, the point I'm getting at is that I don't have 3 world titles, and you know, I started to kind of reflect on some of the decisions that I've made throughout my life of like, wow, you know, what if I had been a little bit more dedicated, or if I had sacrificed a little bit more, you know, like what would I have been able to achieve? And, you know, my question is, do you ever grapple with any of these same concepts, but kind of inverse in terms of sacrifices that you did make that affected friendships or relationships or things that you had to put on the back burner in order to be the best in the world? Like, did being a world champion involve an immense amount of personal sacrifice?
It did. Look, I'll put it this way to you. Just because you become a world champion doesn't mean you're a good person. You know, achieving sporting greatness doesn't mean you're a good person. And, you know, at the end of 2007, like I was so like driven just to win my first world title, and I got to the end of it and I had my fiance at the time and my friends and my family. They were like, all right, we're going to get you back next year. And I was just like, what do you mean? Like I've gone on and done what I wanted to do, and everyone's happy and smiling and this and that. And I was just so focused on me and myself that I didn't even realize when I was, you know, I'd go out to dinner, I wasn't in the room. I wasn't there at all. And so all that sacrifice and all that, you know, all that focusing just on me started just eating away at all my relationships. And so I was gutted when all that sort of came out. And so in 2008, I tried to make up for it, and I went totally the other way, and I sort of sacrificed my career, but that didn't make me happy either. So I was learning how to do this juggling act of, you know, do I just sacrifice all my friends, or do I sacrifice my career just so I'm happy, or they're happy, or, you know, who's becoming happy. And that's another reason why I learned to differentiate the two. It's like, you know, when I'm competing, I'm competing, you know. And then when I'm with friends or with family, I'm with friends or family. And that's why I didn't want the two to mix, because I'd had that pain, and I've had that that breakdown in relationships that just didn't work. So sacrifice is one. You know, I think people don't realize, like, yeah, we sacrifice to become great sporting people, but you also sacrifice to be great at relationships too. Like, you know, sometimes you don't want to go shopping with your wife, and it's like, well, I should, because it will make her happy, you know. And so you do that a little bit, and but it's just balancing those sacrifices. Is it going to make me 100% happy, but or is it not? But if I do sacrifice these things and do go shopping with the wife, then that's going to make her happy, and seeing her happy is going to make me happy. So it's sort of, it's a funny way to look at it. I hope that made sense. But
let me ask you this, though. So was there a payoff, though? So, you know, the sacrifices that you had to make in terms of some of your relationships, when you got the title, was there a payoff, or was it an empty victory? I mean, did it make it all worth it? Or was there a point where you're just like, this is not what I want to do with my life. This is not where I want to be. I mean, there's a huge value in personal relationships, and there's a huge value placed on that trophy. How do you balance those two things?
Yeah, look, it was a huge learning curve, for sure. And it wasn't until like 2009, I looked at it totally different. And I worked really hard to sort of do both, like do the personal relationships, but also do the surfing that I needed to do or work. And I really enjoyed both of them. And that year was a really good year for me. That year was one of the ones where I look at that world title and be like, wow, that was a huge feat for so many different reasons, where 2007 was all about me. So yeah, it was great to include my friends and family at different points around the work. They weren't at work with me, but they were around the work. And that was something that I was extremely proud of, to be able to walk away at the end of 2019 and be like, my relationships are good and my work's good and I'm happy with both of them. So
yeah. And was there a point when you made a conscious decision to shed a certain party lifestyle and really focus on going and being a professional athlete and getting another title? And because it seems like what I've noticed in the time that I was on the North Shore, it seemed like there was this kind of sea change that happened sometime between 2005 and 2010, not just with you, but let's say like Andy Irons, for instance, like he was able to dominate the sport with just an immense amount of raw talent and drive. Mm-hmm. But he did not have personalized dietitians and trainers and coaches and a lot of these things that have kind of become ubiquitous with these younger kids today. And it seemed like there's like this sea change where there used to be a disconnect between the lifestyle of a professional surfer and the lifestyle of a professional athlete, in terms of like how you would think of a basketball player or a football player. And they seem a lot more closely intertwined these days. Was there a point when you really decided to focus on the training part of chasing that title? Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. Yeah, there's an exact moment in time. Look, when I first got on tour, I was sort of like, anyone was having a beer, call Mick, he'll come and have a beer. And that was something that, you know, I enjoyed it. And I made poor decisions on when to do that. And I got injured in 2004, tore my hamstring off the bone, and I'm sitting at home and, you know, I can't walk. I'm stuck on the couch getting fat. And I remember watching a heat where I was against Danny Wills, and I'm sitting there and I'm watching the heat. And in my own mind, when I was surfing that heat, I felt like I got absolutely flogged, like, just so I got blown out of the water pretty much. And I rewatched the heat and I was like, hey, I was a lot closer than what I actually thought I was. And then I started looking back into that heat, and two nights before I was down at the Roquefort in France partying, and I was still slightly hungover for that heat. And so my timing was off, and I had this immense guilt just come over me. I felt like sick and I couldn't sleep. I was just like, just so angry at myself. And this was all before I started the rehab and everything on my leg. And I went into rehab and I was just like, you know what, if I get the opportunity to get back on tour, I'm never feeling that guilt ever again.
When it was happening, you thought, oh, well, this is a blowout and there's no way this was within my reach. Mm-hmm. And then after the fact, you realized that had you made different choices, that things might have turned out differently?
Exactly. Yeah. From that moment on, I was like, yeah, once I get back on tour, I'm going to put my work first and go and do the best I possibly can in my work so I don't have those sleepless, guilty nights ever again. And then if I win or lose or whatever and I feel like having a beer after the fact, then I can go and do it without any guilt. And that was my thing. And people probably saw that and were like, oh, you've got to be fit and healthy, you've got to do this. Because I had a pretty good run after that. And now it's just like everyone's just professional. It's like, yeah, we know too much.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that's a pretty funny story in that this is the exact opposite experience of 99% of surfers where they would actually see video of themselves and be like, oh, I did better than I thought I did. You know, yeah. I mean, like everyone always thinks that they're ripping and then it's pretty horrid to see yourself surfing. So that's a funny perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty honest when I see myself surfing.
I mean, well, there was even one of the quotes that you had given me for the Hawaii book is you were talking about like, yeah, we basically just got to kind of get paid to travel the world and party. And, you know, obviously that came to an end. What are some of the other changes that you noticed in the North Shore over the course of the 10 years since I've been shooting? Cause I felt like it was a really interesting time to get the document and I did it kind of just by accident, but there were so many major shifts that happened, you know, in terms of the ASP turning to the WSL and social media coming into rise and the Brazilians taking over. And then almost the complete collapse of a lot of the surf brands. And then the culture changed so much as well. And I talked to a lot of people and did interviews and, you know, they'd said things like social media and real estate values when people couldn't necessarily afford to live there anymore. But I mean, what are some of the major changes in the last 10 years have changed in the North Shore in your eyes?
I guess during the noughties, the surfing industry was just going like this. It was like they were throwing money at everything. You know, oh yeah, sweet, give that guy 200 grand for doing this or that. And then all of a sudden the GFC hit and everyone's just like, uh-oh, and just all the money just came back into the brands. And that was a big thing. And then obviously, real estate was a big one, but I think the first times that I used to go to the North Shore, it was a really heavy place. It was like the local guys ran such a tight ship. Like if you stepped out of line, you're just like, oh God, where's the slap coming from, you know? And then, yeah, all this money and more attention came to it. And then that started dwindling down the fact because there was so much more attention on this strip. There were so many more cameras and so, you know, what guys were getting away with earlier in the piece, they couldn't get away with that anymore. You know, it was like, it was on every camera, you know. You see it, and if someone punches, even have a verbal disagreement these days, it's on social media before they even hit the beach. Yeah. And it's like, they just can't control it that much anymore. So that I think that's been the biggest thing. You know, I really like the days where, you know, you sort of just you'd surf and you'd make sure, like, you'd take a mental note of who was out in the water. Because if you dropped in on one of those people, it was just like, oh God, I'm dead. and you, it was a really big, like, learn of respect thing. And it was really cool, especially respecting your elders, respecting the locals. And then it sort of, yeah, opened up. And yeah, it's just huge, huge changes. I think social media is something that's changed the world forever, but I think it changed that strip of the world immensely.
Yeah, I mean, I feel so lucky to have gotten to document that time period.
Yeah, it was, it's pretty special, you know. Some of the fondest memories on tour from that time in winter being over there. You know, I go back and look at photos and stuff and just, you know, I guess for me, in my early years on tour, I was so lucky. I got to live with Andy Irons and Bruce Irons and and see how the superstars of the North Shore got to live, and you know, like these puppy dogs looking up at the big dogs. It was pretty incredible.
Is there one standout memory that you have on the North Shore? That I mean, like when you're 60 and your kids are asking you about what it was like. Is there one standout memory that kind of is defining of your time over there?
Look, the first one that comes to mind was standing in the yard and watching Paco win his world title. That was that because I was just a passenger of his story, and just being able to sit and just, you know, just feel all that emotion and feel everything else. I'd never been in that situation, and to have like one of your best friends go through it, and you know, you're riding the emotion with his wife and, you know, family, and normally you're competing. I wasn't competing, I'd already lost, so I was got to sit in the yard and feel that. Yeah, that's a moment that was just like, I don't know, it's sort of, for me, it still brings up a lot of joy and almost tears of joy in a sense. But there's so many incredible moments. You know, I was in the house when Andy won the showdown against Kelly and you know, all that sort of stuff. That was incredible as well. But yeah, for the one moment, I think seeing Paco win and being able to run down and give one of my best mates that hug of winning a world title was something incredible.
I think that says a lot, that the memory you remember is one of your best friends winning a title and not yourself. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like, because you're so in the moment, you don't get all the different feelings coming through. You know, you just like, as we're talking before, you're at work. And so you're so focused on what you're doing that you don't get to take everything else in. And so, yeah, that's probably why I look at that moment as I could really appreciate it for everything that was in it.
Yeah. I mean, I witnessed that a little bit. There was one year for one of your titles, you were standing on the sand and it was a after heat decision. You didn't know if you'd won the title yet. And there was like a mayhem and crowd surrounding you. And you're just like, what's the score? What's the score? Yeah. And you were just so like, you had just the focus in your eye was like nothing I'd ever seen. And then you finally realized that you won the title and it set in and you broke down for a moment and you had your minute and then took a breath. And then it was just full on like chair up the beach and like party time, you know, and I got to see this whole panorama of emotions. It was special to get to capture that and be there and see that.
Yeah. The emotion that goes into it. I think that's why you see when sporting people, they break down and when they win something or whatever, there's so much more than just what people see in the competition. There's like all the backdraft of, you know, those days of getting up early and going to training when you don't want to and dealing with everything. Yeah.
It speaks to the sacrifice that I was asking about. Mm. You know, it's like getting up at 4 a.m. and training instead of, you know, sleeping in and eating bacon or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, and I think that's part of the reason why those moments are so emotional. Yeah.
There was actually a moment in the, you know, that only I got to see was that morning of that world title that you spoke of. I paddled out and it was absolutely huge and I was shitting myself. And I was in a heat against CJ Hobgood. And I remember paddling over a wave and looking back into shore and just to see all the crowd on the beach. And then just as I'd sort of gone up, it was sort of like this huge curtain raise of like a big show sort of starting. And the sun came out and just hit all the people on the beach and like all the people just erupted. And that's a moment for me, like to be able to take a moment in whilst competing. That was a really special one for me.
And it's a perspective that you and CJ and probably Water Patrol saw. I mean, it was such a private moment to be able to witness
that. Yeah, and I wasn't talking to CJ at the time because I was, you know, there. But, yeah, it was...
game face. Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, no, it was a really, really cool moment just to... Like, if I could take a picture and put it on a screen out of my brain, I could it's so clear as day.
So amazing. Well, so I saw on your Instagram that you went swimming with sharks. Did I read that correctly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did that come about? What was that like? Was it kind of a moment of reconciliation, or how did that come about?
Yeah, it was weird. It was, so what it was, I got asked to do a documentary with Taylor Steele and Mick Lawrence, who are two guys I really like. That obviously Taylor Steele, everyone knows him in the surfing world as the Momentum Generation, and then his producer, Mick Lawrence. They asked me if I wanted to do a documentary on sharks, and I was like, oh, do I, don't I? And then I was like, yeah, let's do it. Let's go for it. And they were like, well, this is our dream scenarios. One, you go down to South Australia and you swim with great whites in a cage. And I was like, okay, I can do the cage part. that's sweet. And then after we did that, we went to Miami, and you know, it was tags and bull sharks and stuff like that with the University of Miami there, and then from there we went over to Bahamas and we swam with reef sharks, hammerheads, and then finished it off with tiger sharks. And it was confronting, only for the fact that, you know, from my incidents in the past, I wanted to see if I had fully healed from that incident. But also, too, I felt like I wanted to learn about sharks, and because I feel like sharks just get such a bad rap, I wanted to learn and figure out why they're worth saving. And so, it was a really cool journey, not only for, you know, learning about doing a doco, but also personally I could go and see if I was ready to come face to face with something that I almost got eaten by.
Yeah. Are you, I'm curious how you feel about people associating you with that incident. Like, for instance, I'll put it in perspective. We had Ireland Baldwin on the show recently, and, you know, despite all of her subsequent career accomplishments, so many people still think of her as the person that Alec Baldwin left this voicemail message for, and then it got released to the media. And I think, you know, similarly, surfing is so much bigger in Australia than the United States. And if you ask somebody who doesn't follow surfing who Mick Fanning is, may not ring a bell. But if you say, oh, yeah, you know, the professional surfer who got the show, they're like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, so, I mean, you're definitely associated with, is that incident going to, you know, kind of haunt you for the rest of your life? Are you tired of talking about that?
Look, it's funny. I've explained this to people before. You know, I have three different versions of it. If it's just some random guy walking down the street, just go, oh, shark guy, I'm like, yeah, whatever, and just keep walking and don't pay attention to it. And then there's the media side where you sort of, as we were talking about earlier, you know, building up walls, I can tell the story without breaking down the wall. I can just tell the story, but then...
And it's concise and kind of almost, you know, preformed.
It's... Yeah. Like pressing play. And then there's the one where I can sit down and if I really trust the person I'm telling, then I can go through the whole thing with them. And, you know, sometimes I cry, sometimes I don't. But, I know if I can trust that person, I know that I'm in a safe place to be able to, If I need help getting back to normal, then that person's there to help me out. So they're sort of my three different stages of telling the story. Look, as we were saying before, like, surfing's something I do. It's not who I am. The shark incident, it just happened. I can't control what people think, so I don't really pay too much attention to it. So I'm not really too fussed about it. Like, it's not like I wake up every day and look in the mirror and go, hey, shark guy. You know, I'm not that person.
Wow, that's really interesting. That's really an honest way of putting it. We have like the kind of three different ways of explaining it, depending on your level of interest and comfort, you know?
Yeah.
Well, we always like to end this show by giving guests an opportunity to plug something that they feel maybe hasn't gotten enough attention, whether it's like a TV show or a movie or a book or a surfer. Like, is there anybody that you want to kind of give some shine to and give a shout out to that you you feel hasn't got the attention they deserve?
They all get it. No, I'm joking. I don't know. I'm not really doing any projects or anything like that. I guess it's more about just people just being kind to each other, really. We always try and focus. Like, we don't mean to focus on it, but we always take the bad out of something. For instance, you have a look on your Instagram page and you'll have 50 amazing comments where people are super psyched for you, and then there'll just be one and it'll just, you know, might just say you're a prick, but you'll focus on that person. You don't even know the person. My thing is just keep trying to focus on the good, and, you know, we can, the more focus on the good that we can do, the better off the world's going to be for the next generations.
You definitely have a vested interest in that next generation now.
Sure do. We both do.
Well, listen, Mick, I remember, you know, I went over to the North Shore shooting my book project for 10 years straight. Most years I was by myself. 1 year I brought over my wife, Lisa, and we'd just gotten married and we went out to dinner at Lele's and she really wanted to meet you. And you had just won your title that evening or that day. I went over, I introduced you to her. And I remember you sat down at the table and you took 10 minutes and you talked and you listened and you asked questions, to the extent that somebody from your party actually came over and said, "Hey, champ, there's a party waiting for you." And I'll always remember that. I think that was just such a kind thing to do. And it really speaks to your generosity and your character. And you're going to be a great dad, mate. So
thanks,
really,
man. Appreciate it.
I appreciate you. I appreciate you sitting down, man. I really do.
Oh, man, I remember that night. Say hello to her for me. As I said before, just because you're a good sports person or whatever, it doesn't mean you're a good person. So just try and be a good person. And
I think you're doing a good job, man. And I wish you all the best. And hopefully our paths will cross soon. And stick around. I want to get your address. I'll send you a copy of the book because I think you'll really love it. You're a big part of it.
I can't wait. I always loved getting the photos each and every year. It's cool.
All right, mate. Take care.
No worries, man. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and a huge thanks to today's guest for dropping in. If you enjoyed this episode, do us a favor and take a minute to rate, review, follow, or subscribe. This episode of The Plug was executive produced by Ryan Bucci and Peter Buckingham. Theme music by Andrew Van Weingarten and Dan Drohan, with sound design by Brad Worrell at Soundwag. Thanks again, and be sure to tune in for future conversations.
And don't forget to post your job for free at linkedin.com/surf. That's linkedin.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.